When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made this. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for another episode in which I'm really pleased to be discussing a book which was published earlier this year by Chicago Review Press. The book is called Phantom Lady, Hollywood producer Joan Harrison, the forgotten woman behind Hitchcock. And I'm really pleased to be joined by the book's author, Christina Lane. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, the pleasure's all mine. Just before we start then and talk about the book and so on, I was just wondering if you could just tell us a bit maybe about your day job at the University of Miami, just so we can get a kind of sense of who you are and so on.
Sure. I'm at the University of Miami. I teach film studies, women in film, directors, history. I also chair the Department of the Cinematic Arts. So I oversee production and screenwriting and the business of film, which I enjoy. I really love what I do.
I was really intrigued to read that you're the director of for the Norton Herrick Center for Motion Picture Studies, which apparently has a vast collection. Could you tell me a bit about that, please?
Yeah, we actually were lucky enough to get a donation from what's called the Video Yesteryear Collection, which in the 80s was a really terrific kind of mail order collection of obscure titles and classics and silence, kind of underground cinema. So we have the collection and have been able to digitize it for our students and keep it on hand. And we also do a lot of encouraging of research and kind of preservation of film and a lot of programming here at the University of Miami. So it's really a pleasure to encourage a lot of outreach and, you know, film viewing.
Yeah, sounds really fantastic. Now, normally when I speak to somebody new on the podcast, one of the things I generally ask is just a very general question about where your passion for film began. So I was intrigued at the back of your book, you mentioned in the acknowledgements an Aunt Barbara who maybe encouraged this. Is that right?
Yeah, it's true. My Aunt Barbara Joasis, who's my father's sister. So she really did a nice, you know, what she did for me is she recognized, and as I was in my early 20s, this interest in that I had in women in film. And she just kind of encouraged that along because she, I think, was one of those, you know, not to reduce her in any way, but, you know, she kind of grew up in a relatively conservative environment in Southern Virginia, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, and was a stay-at-home mom with a lot of children. And I think she saw a way for her to encourage me to kind of stretch my wings. So anytime she went to a bookstore, she would, or a book signing, she would send me, you know, a signed copy of a book about women in film. And she was just really fabulous about, I think, channeling her own passions through me.
So were there any particular films or, I don't know, film stars, film directors who, when you were at a younger age, you know, developing that passion, were especially formative for you or not?
You know, even back then, my favorite films were Hitchcock films, I think, you know, especially the Gothic ones. So my interests go all the way back to Rebecca and Suspicion and, you know, The Lady Vanishes. So, yeah. and also, I think those kind of Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, Carol Lombard films.
All right. So let's talk a bit about the book, I suppose. So in the introduction, you describe Joan Harrison's life, I think, as one of the last great untold stories of the classical Hollywood era. So I was just kind of wondering how you became aware of Joan Harrison.
Yeah, you know, and I would say, you know, I'm someone who is as intrigued as anybody by Alfred Hitchcock. You know, I've certainly read everything I could get my hands on about Hitchcock and seen a lot of his movies. So I would put myself in that camp as being someone who really is a Hitchcock connoisseur. not to flatter myself, but somebody who really enjoys his movies. But I began to see that there's so many women that have influenced his career and shaped his career. And this was maybe in the 1990s when I was in graduate school, and I became aware of the fact that, first of all, right, going back to the very beginning of his own career, Alma Revel, his wife before she was even his wife, basically began to kind of tutor him and train him in filmmaking, and was highly influential. And he even trained in the early 1920s under an all-female unit that was sent to the UK from the United States by the American company Famous Players Lasky. So, and he attributed those women to helping bring him along in film. And even just being aware of Sally Benson, who worked on the screenplay for Shadow of a Doubt, and Jay Preston Allen, who worked on Marnie, and then of course Joan Harrison, who was with him for 30 years.
Yeah.
And so I was particularly, I guess, tuned into this, or I would give a lot of credit to one of my professors when I was in graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin. And that was Professor Thomas Schatz, who wrote the book, The Genius of the System, about Alfred Hitchcock and a lot of different directors in the classical studio system. And he pointed me to the Harry Ransom Center, which is full of archives focused on David O. Selznick at the University of Texas at Austin. And that's where I really began to focus on Joan Harrison in particular, because there are some papers on her, just a few. And so the seeds were planted, and that was, you know, in the 1990s, a wonderful time to be in Austin, Texas, by the way, as that area was flourishing for film. But I really didn't actually know what to do with all of that for a number of years. And I thought I wanted to write a book about kind of all of these women, which was quite overwhelming. And it was only until more recently that I thought I really wanted to tell just one story, one biography. And it was clear that Joan Harrison was the right subject for that, partly because of how many years she worked with Hitchcock, and also because she, as I say in my book, I think she was the original Hitchcock blonde.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. But I was just wondering about the sort of research required then when it became evident this would be the book project, because I think you say there's no official collection of her papers. So I'm assuming that makes it much harder out of the starting gate. And I was really struck at the back of the book by just how many archives and archivists and librarians are mentioned in the acknowledgements. So what was the process like, I guess?
It was really challenging to find, obviously, as you say, there were no Joan Harrison papers, right? There's no collection, which is frustrating. And she left behind, you know, very little. I think that she didn't kind of recognize her own significance. So there's, and she was married to Eric Ambler, the spy novelist. So one would think that you could go to Eric Ambler's papers and maybe that way find some nice collection of her letters, right? Or kind of correspondence, but there was nothing there. So yeah, I did go to, I think I went to at least a dozen, you know, maybe upwards of 20 different archives across the United States and some in the UK. And that was one angle in, is that you could kind of look at the Hitchcock collections, you know, to find Joan Harrison.
Yeah.
Or some other directors and producers to kind of find an imprint of hers. But the truth is that the archives would only get me so far, and the best sources for finding the, you know, kind of the deepest level of research turned out to be human sources. You know, the people were the key, really critical for her. And that ended up being the people who were with her really toward the end of her life. Like the person who took care of her toward the end of her life. Actually, when I found her, and it wasn't easy, but she ended up being written into the will for Eric Ambler. This is Jacqueline McKink. So I wouldn't have found her unless her name was actually in that will. And when I found her, she had written a 200-page memoir to kind of mark her own time living with Eric Ambler and Joan Harrison, which is unpublished, and it was just kind of a personal expression, but it was something she shared with me. And that's something that I think every historian or biography just, you know, wishes that they could fall into, is 200 pages of something written by a caretaker or a housekeeper or, you know.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions actually about the people you spoke to. So am I right in thinking you spoke to Norman Lloyd, who, if I'm not mistaken, recently turned 106, if that's right. So what was it like speaking with him?
Yes. And he was definitely crucial to the research. And so Norman Lloyd, as you know, was in Saboteur, right? And in a number of Hitchcock, he was in television shows and in films with Hitchcock, as well as producing, you know, producing with Joan Harrison, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. So he was helpful because, well, first of all, his memory is still, you know, fresh. It's spot on.
It's great.
And he is 106, and until very recently was playing tennis, you know, every Saturday. So, So, and he knew her on a day-to-day basis. You know, he knew her very personally and had a kind of a front row seat to her life, her personal and professional life. And so, he just adored her so that he could give me a sense of her in three dimensions. The other thing that was helpful in speaking to Norman is that I spoke to him over several times over the course of a number of years. So at each time I talked to him, he would kind of corroborate the things that he'd said before, and I could really trust what he was saying.
Yeah. Anything for Joan, I think, was the quote of his that I think was in the book, which I really liked. It also seems kind of, I don't know how it feels to you, but it seemed kind of poignant to me that several of the people you interviewed actually passed away before the book came out. So people like Joseph Stefano, or I think you mentioned J. Preston Allen already. Yeah. I guess it just kind of underscores how lengthy the process of putting the book together was.
Definitely. Along the way, and even Carol Lindley had given me a nice interview. She was an actress who was in a couple of those Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes, and she spoke so fondly of Joan Harrison as a great role model in the 1950s and 60s, and she had passed away, I think, within a year of the book coming out. So even going back to the fact that I was interested in doing this book in the mid-1990s, and Eric Ambler passed away, I think, in 1997. So I just felt like the whole way, you know, if I'd figured out that I wanted to do this just a little bit earlier, I could have caught a lot of these interviews.
Okay. So I guess the thing, one something we could do is maybe paint a bit of a picture of Joan Harrison for those listeners who are unfamiliar with her. I suppose to start with, what kind of background did she have? So from Guildford in England, of course.
Yeah.
What could you say about her kind of upbringing and her background? It seemed quite nice in some respects.
Yes, it was. Have you been to Guildford?
Yeah, some time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so and I did have the opportunity to visit, which is, you know, gives me a good view into her childhood and her life. And I mean, you know, Guildford, Surrey, obviously it has this medieval history, right? I mean, I think that getting a sense of place for Joan Harrison is really important. She grew up in this, at that time, I mean, it wasn't a village, it was a town or a city, right? But that has this, it goes back to the 13th century in terms of its French Saxon architecture. And at the same time, you feel like you're walking through the footsteps of Lewis Carroll, you know, in this Alice in Wonderland yeah. feeling, because Lewis Carroll did spend a lot of time there and did some of his writing there. So I think for someone like Joan Harrison, it has this really mystical quality, almost as though fairies are kind of dancing around in the gardens and the and you know, the kind of pastures of Guildford. But she was born there to a newspaper family, you know, to actually the people who ran the Surrey Advertiser, right? And she wanted to be a reporter, at least this is what she says, kind of in retrospect, that she wanted to work for the newspaper. And her father felt that that would be too masculine, quote unquote masculine, for a career for a woman in the early 20th century. She was also Oxford graduate. So she was really quite ambitious, also gorgeous. And she could have just kind of, as she says, she could have settled down into a town and country marriage. Her parents definitely wanted to see her in that role and have a life of leisure. But she wanted a life of adventure, you know, and she chose this kind of risk associated with going into the life of the movies, which yeah. at that time, you know, in the 1930s was seen, especially I think for a woman of her stature and in her kind of class, was much, it was seen as trivial. You know, the movies for a woman like her was seen as really a step down. And when she, and you know, I guess we can talk a little bit about what happened when she became a part of the Hitchcock team. But when she did, she became a part of that adoptive family. You know, she kind of left her own family behind and became a part of the Hitchcocks, which is an interesting move for her because she really did kind of become reborn.
Yeah, just before we come on to the collaboration with Hitchcock, sounded to me like there's some very interesting facets to her character, which come across through the book. So some sense of snobbishness, is that right? So she could be quite snobby? Is that accurate? Yes.
Yeah, right. I mean, and I did want to peel some of these layers back because obviously you don't, I wanted to see what her flaws were, you know, what yeah. are the negative traits. She wasn't perfect and she did keep her guard up. You know, she was very guarded. She was, as I talk about in the book, she didn't particularly like her sister, you know, and one of the reasons she didn't like her sister is because her sister was only a teacher, right?
Right.
So she had certain ideas about what people should and should not do with their lives and what women should and shouldn't do. And she was also very stubborn, which was a great trait to have as she was making her way up through a career, but also could limit her, you know, her determination and her kind of stubborn will could certainly, it was also something that could limit her.
I think one of the quotes that jumped out at me is about her brief career as a shop girl. And I think the quote is, at the end of the day, I found myself loathing women. So I don't know if that ties into the snobbishness
yes.
thing. Also, and this is kind of jumping around a bit, but someone who had very defined and, you know, clear political views, but quite comfortable working with people who had different outlooks too, it seemed like, quite collegiate in that sense, which is interesting when you come to like the HUAC period and things like that.
Yeah. Yes. She did. I mean, most people who would describe Joan Harrison, you know, I think before I did this research, I didn't understand how left-leaning she was, you know, how progressive she was. She came off, I think, in the media or in kind of the publicity as fairly neutral politically, you know. And yet she clearly had, her consciousness had kind of been raised by working with a lot of people who were expats and who had been who were working as kind of artists in Hollywood at a time when their own safety and their freedom were jeopardized. So she had really, again, moved toward the left as she moved into Hollywood. And she helped people out during the HUAC period, you know, again, not to jump around too much, but we do find out that toward the late 1940s and early 1950s, she went out on a limb and she helped people out who were being exiled or blacklisted when other people wouldn't go there. At the same time, as we know, when she was working with someone like Robert Montgomery, who was much more toward the right, she kind of yeah. let that go, right? And she was collegial with him and found a way to make room for a lot of different views, as you say.
And the other thing that jumped out at me was kind of how she could be quite stoic, it sounds like. So like when her sister Muriel unexpectedly died, I think it was a car crash, wasn't it? And and Joan Harrison forced herself to keep going. I suppose, is that just indicative of the time? You know, British people of that time period, you know, were famed to stiff upper lip and all of that. I guess it plays into that.
Yes, yes. She dealt with the kind of shocking death of her brother and her sister all within about a year or two. And I do know that those were different times when people were dealing, you know, with loss and the war coming, you know, and as you say, it was a different culture. But it is interesting that she decided to move, you know, to the United States and to start this career at that, essentially right at that moment. So while she loved her mother dearly and she cared about her family, it didn't hold her back. Her, you know, her sibling's death did not hold her back and keep her moored to her home and her family, even when she lost two siblings really unexpectedly.
So when she was introduced to Hitchcock, it sounds like there's kind of an apocryphal story which changes a bit in the telling about their first meeting. So what is the truth about that as far as you can ascertain?
I think it's really hard to tell, partly because Joan Harrison herself, right, tells us the story of their meeting over and over again in newspaper articles when she comes to Hollywood. So to tell a truthful tale would be really, really difficult. Yeah. But she definitely, you know, had reached a point at her early career, right, where she was kicking around and didn't know what she wanted to do with her life, and had tried work as a sales girl, right, and as a typist, and even short story writing. So she knew she wanted to do something creative. And when she apparently had gone back home to Guilford and was lost, was in this kind of lost state as a bachelorette, so she's given, you know, this kind of morning breakfast tray, and she sees that her friend has sent her this article that says, you know, personal assistant wanted or secretary wanted for a film producer. She heads into town, right, into London, and she gets in line for what she realizes is an interview with Hitchcock. And what's hard to tell is, you know, at first she says there were maybe 20 women in line, maybe 40. And at some point she begins to tell the story that there were 200 women in line for the job. And she raises, you know, she realizes she's never going to make it because I guess the job interview is closing in about 10 minutes. So as the story goes, she races up to the front of the line and tells the man at the front, right, that she's got to go to the hospital because her sister's having a baby. Which is all a fabrication. but he ushers her in, and Hitchcock gives her a few moments of his time. And at the time, he needed someone who spoke German because he was about to go into production on The Man Who Knew Too Much. And he had several crew members, top level crew members, and also Peter Lorre, who would be in the cast. And he needed someone who could translate. So his first kind of concern was, do you speak German? And she felt that that was it. She'd lost her opportunity, but because she'd studied French, right, at Oxford, her modern language major was a focus on French. So as she tells the story, she's kind of tries to coyly say, you know, no, but I speak French. And he said, you know, well, that's it. It's okay. I'm famished. You're hired. Let's go to lunch. And But the good news was that then they went to lunch and he got to know her over the meal and found out that they were kindred spirits, that she loved true crime and loved movies, and that she was going to work out just fine.
So I suppose what people most need to know is that Harrison collaborated on, I believe it was 9 Hitchcock films, and this was a period that spanned his late films in Britain and then his early films in America. I suppose what people will wonder is exactly how collaboration with somebody like Hitchcock would have worked. Like, how hands-on was he? What kind of autonomy did he allow other people? And what kind of role did someone like Joan Harrison play? She was taken on as a personal assistant and then moved on to different roles. Is that right?
Yes, right. So within just a few weeks, she was moved into more of a role of development, right? Which would be reading stories to Hitchcock, looking for material for him, looking out for material, and then actually becoming more of a gatekeeper, right? And so finding stories, helping to develop them, and then soon becoming a screenwriter. But as you say, the most important thing is really understanding the process of the creative process and the development process with Hitchcock, because it really was a collaborative process in terms of, you know, Hitchcock, he would say that early stage was the most important and crucial stage. You know, the joke that he would tell in terms of once the writing is done and he's on the set, you know, he can basically fall asleep, right? Everything is basically finished. His work is finished. Yeah. And I think that was true in the sense that the real work was done in that kind of talking out loud, speaking out loud, you know, spinning a web of story of the story. And so that would generally happen in these conversations kind of around either the dining room table or around the living room or maybe in an office, but generally kind of in the morning when he would bring together one or two writers and someone like Joan Harrison. You know, prior to Joan, it was Alma Revel. And the writers who would sit with him would say essentially that they had no idea when the writing took place, you know, that they felt that he was just kind of blabbing. and John Houseman, who was a producer who would work with him in the United States in the 1940s, you know, said essentially, you know, that writing with Hitchcock was more like, you know, listening to Hitchcock and just kind of right, listening to a series of anecdotes and revelations and things that he brought with him. But the most important thing about that is that Hitchcock, he was very good at bringing in, right, a little kernel moment here or a visual there, but he wasn't a writer and he wasn't particularly great at structure or stringing all of this along into overarching themes or coming up with the characters that would populate a story. And that's where Joan Harrison came in, because she was great at story and all she cared about was character. And the other thing to remember is that there was a team. So you would often have a male writer in the room, you know, you'll see the credits. So you'll see that Joan Harrison wasn't the only person on the credits, but it actually depended on that process. So you would kind of have this dominant male writer voice, and then you would have this reliable kind of constant female voice. And then you would have Hitchcock as this kind of third point in the triangle. And it was necessary to have all of that going on.
And I suppose one of the really intriguing things, which you've already alluded to, is the idea of Joan as a Hitchcock blonde. So Hitchcock's fantasized visions of blonde women. So relevant to her, and it kind of parallels what's starting to go on with his films from, I guess, the 39 Steps onwards, it sounds like. So how direct is, you know, what's the exact nature of their relationship, I gather, is the subject of some rumor, and it's not entirely clear. Mm-hmm. So how would you characterize that?
Right. I know. I mean, so it's true that she kind of Joan Harrison comes on the scene right around the time that Madeline Carroll, who's known as the first Hitchcock blonde, comes on the scene as well. So during the 39 Steps, which is to say that, you know, soon after The Man Who Knew Too Much is made, they're developing the 39 Steps, and Madeline Carroll is being cast for that film. And she's cast kind of at the last minute. So they didn't expect Madeline Carroll to be in the 39 Steps. And when they finally did realize that they would have her, in terms of Alfred Hitchcock and Alma Revel and the whole team realized that they would have Madeline Carroll, they began to reshape, you know, the role of the main female character in the 39 Steps. And so, which is to say that Madeline Carroll kind of brings her own persona.
Yeah.
Which is very close to Joan Harrison's own kind of biographical story, you know, and her look into the film. And also Carol brings her performative style. Meanwhile, Joan Harrison is kind of helping to write the pages, right? At the last minute, she's on the set helping to write these pages that define the character of Pamela. And so that's just kind of one story point, like one plot point in the overarching kind of Hitchcock-Harrison arc. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that when you have basically Hitchcock and Joan Harrison working so closely all the time in this creative atmosphere, it was pretty obvious that Hitchcock began to kind of develop this fantasy, and it's very much in his mind about Joan, and that he's kind of channeling his ideas about her kind of romantically and sexually onto the screen. So I, you know, as I say in the book, Phantom Lady, I don't think that there was anything that went on, you know, and that Joan Harrison would have put a stop to that pretty quickly, because she always did kind of walk out, right? Whenever she saw something going on that she didn't approve of, or that she found offensive to her, she walked out of a studio, she walked out, you know, of an office. So I don't think that she would have stood for anything that she...
Yeah.
That bothered her. But at the same time, she probably allowed a certain amount of fantasizing to go on in Hitchcock's mind, because it fueled their own, you know, the writing process. And the same thing would be true for Alma Revel, as I say in the book, mm-hmm. you know, that Alma Revel was probably fully aware of what this did for Hitchcock creatively. And she and Harrison probably fed all of this together, you know, as two women who were quite close.
It's so interesting as well, isn't it? Because one of the other stories in the book is about, was Hitchcock able to kind of fluster Joan by showing her, is it a vulgar passage from Ulysses? I haven't read Ulysses, so I don't know right. what was so shocking, but
right.
That was part of his kind of weird kind of power plays and all of that.
Yes. And that's probably the worst moment, you know, that Joan had to endure with Hitchcock, described by Charles Bennett. A screenwriter, right? One of the screenwriters that was there on the scene most of the time in the mid 1930s. And he describes Hitchcock calling Joan Harrison in the early days of their working together and reading the toilet passage, right? The toilet scene from Ulysses, which is very vulgar and would have really put her on edge and made her feel uncomfortable, especially if she didn't know Hitchcock very well, meaning that it was a real test and would not have passed the Me Too movement today, right? It was really wrong of him to do. But people liken it to the way that he also put actresses through the test, through various tests to see kind of what they would do if they were made to feel vulnerable. And she clearly felt vulnerable. She felt kind of stripped down. And what I say in the book is that she basically never let that happen again. You know, that she recognized that he was a menace in terms of his practical jokes and his desire to really kind of take people down. He was a complicated and sometimes really mean person. But she figured that out.
So I just wanted to mention a couple of the films in particular, the Hitchcock films she worked on. So Rebecca, you say, sees her hitting her stride. So it's such an interesting film, of course, and a compromised film because of the restrictions of the time and what David O. Selznick was doing and all that, which I kind of knew about. What I didn't realize was that Joan had to kind of water down some of the heroine's moxie. Mm-hmm. So what was her kind of original vision, and what did she have to kind of, how did she have to tone it down?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I do want people to know is just how much, you know, time Joan Harrison put into Rebecca, right? That she kind of discovered, not that, you know, people knew that Daphne du Maurier was working on the novel Rebecca. But that she kind of made it her mission to acquire the manuscript and make it Hitchcock's film, and eventually Selznick and Hitchcock's film. And so I think that what she wanted to do is, what she does with every single female protagonist, you know, of hers, that she wants to make her female characters more assertive. She wants to bring them more kind of power and narrative agency. So even if it wasn't particularly right for, you know, this adaptation of Rebecca, if it wasn't particularly right for the second Mrs. De Winter to be, you know, stronger, I think Joan Harrison wanted her to be a little bit stronger even from the beginning, and then really take on more power by the time, you know, she finds out what happened to Rebecca. And Selznick and his kind of representatives just kind of fought back and said that obviously he was always wanting to be more faithful to the novel. So they kept pushing back on that. And it seems as though basically Joan was able to get a little bit more, I don't know whether it would just be kind of psychological strength, you know, or kind of psychological depth. She just kind of kept working the textures of the character along the way, and probably tried to work with Joan Fontaine as well. But I'm not sure that you could say that necessarily that the character is particularly strong. She becomes strong, you know, as she confronts Mrs. Danvers.
Yeah. So I'm just going to ask you to speculate. I don't know if you've seen the 2020 adaptation of Rebecca.
Yeah.
Do you think Joan Harrison might have approved? Because in that film, she does have a bit more autonomy and she drives things a little bit more, doesn't she?
She does.
Do you think she would have approved?
That is really hard to judge. It is. Given just how sunshiny and superficial, I guess I would say the film is, but in terms of the characterization, she might approve of the difference in the characterization. And I think what I think that film does is it really does pull off the Mrs. Danvers character a little bit better, you know, and suggests that there was a bit more depth in that relationship between Rebecca and Mrs. Danvers. So she may have enjoyed that.
I mean, yeah, who knows, of course. Then Suspicion was after Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And I really liked the idea of tactical smuggling, I think was the quote. Joan's tactical smuggling through that film, which again is another interesting one because of all the back and forth about the ending and so on. So what do you think her smuggling was there? What did she smuggle in?
Oh, well, I think that particularly in terms of the subtext between the... in terms of Isabel's relationship, I'm actually totally forgetting. Do I use those words? I'm like forgetting my own.
Smuggling is there. I think I've put quotes around it on my page. So yeah.
But is that in context of the lesbian subtext, or is that just in terms of the?
I believe it comes right at the end of the chapter. I can't remember if it's directly next to that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think that although I don't remember those words exactly, I do think that what she's doing there is bringing in a lot of her own interests, right? And sneaking them into the adaptation. And partly there's very little in the original novel, before the fact, that points to anything really kind of homoerotic or homotextual, say, right? And so I think that it's really interesting that both kind of Alma Revel and Joan Harrison are really working that adaptation as much as they had to basically give up on, they're just fighting the censors in terms of the ending. And as you know, there are like five different endings for the film and they're battling over Cary Grant's persona. But then on the side, they're basically able to distraction, find a way to focus on Isabel Sudbusk, the detective novelist, right, the mystery writer, and then her relationship, the woman, it's kind of obvious, her lover's name, I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, so around the dinner table during the dinner party, it's just obvious that they are lovers, that they have a very intimate relationship, and that all was basically added in, you know, by Joan and Alma. And there's a lot of kind of coding and color coding as well as dialogue and insinuation that I think is just so interesting given the way that we see that then through Joan's other films.
And then as the 40s continues, Harrison becomes a, quote, no holds barred producer.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it's worth stating that it wasn't all plain sailing in the sense that there were films that she'd worked on that maybe she wrote that didn't maybe came out very differently to what she envisioned, or there were projects that went nowhere and so on, but just part and parcel of the way the system worked, I suppose.
Right.
Or not.
Right. Yeah. So I think that there was a way in which, you know, the studio system made it very difficult for anybody to get, you know, to push their own kind of creative vision through. And she had found frustration because, having worked with Hitchcock, she'd found a certain ability to have films made, right, and kind of fight the production code administration with Hitchcock. But then when she went out on her own, it wasn't nearly as easy. On the other hand, you know, if she, you know, again, kind of to understand the sexism involved, if she had been a male executive, right, or a male producer, I think she could have pushed a lot more through and she wouldn't have faced nearly as much resistance. And she would have risen to a level that she just wasn't able to rise to. And she probably, her name would be more of a household name today. if she'd been a man, you know, to put it, put a point on it.
So one film in particular I wanted to mention was Phantom Lady, which of course gives the book its name, and it's quite fitting at the moment because it's Noirvember, hashtag Noirvember, which I watched the film last night. I hadn't seen it before and I really enjoyed it. So as you talk about in the book, an atypical woman character for film noir in Nella Raines' character, and it sounds like a lot of that can be attributed to Joan. Is that correct?
Yeah, particularly because the Cornell Woolridge novel on which it's based, you know, the Phantom Lady novel, is really not very much like the film. I mean, the twists that Joan gives it are clearly pointed toward this female secretary, or, you know, the female the secretary turned detective. That whole twist is Joan Harrison's kind of novelty. And so it's interesting that she kind of, and, you know, people say this, I think it's true, projects her own kind of dilemmas of being kind of a corporate, you know, a woman professional in a male dominated system onto that character. And even her style, the fashion, you know, and the clothes that she wears, she basically dresses Ella Raines' character, Kansas, you know, or Carol Richmond, in the same kinds of clothes that she liked to wear. So there's a stylization of the character, but also just the idea that this woman who doesn't really think that she can take on much, you know, becomes the key, you know, becomes the narrative agent to solving the mystery. And we might say, well, it's because she wants to save her man, you know, rescue the man who is about to go to death, to his death, for a crime that he didn't commit. But it's really much more than that. She comes into her own and discovers her power.
And I'm not familiar with the book, but it's quite hard for me to imagine having seen the film, because it works really well. It's got that kind of pivot, what is it, like 25 minutes in. But it sounded like the book was more kind of split in focus. It would go from character to character.
Yes.
So it sounds to me, it seems from what I've read and from seeing the film, that it works really well with its tighter focus on her character, Ella Raines' character.
Yeah.
So I suppose one of the main points in the book is that you sort of see a prevailing themes across Joan Harrison's body of work, to the extent that we can look at her as a producer, as kind of an author figure. Is that fair to say? That's what you would suggest?
Yeah, I do. I see that she brought a particular vision, you know, or particular kind of tropes and conventions to most of her films, including the ones she did with Hitchcock and then the ones that she did on her own.
Do you feel like she would have thought about herself in such terms, or would she have? Or would she not really have thought that way, perhaps?
So I think that she saw her interests, you know, overriding interests and themes that did prevail throughout her films, because she would talk about them all the time and, you know, in interviews, right? So she saw herself as having a set of kind of obsessions.
Yeah.
But your question of, you know, would she have seen herself as an auteur, right? Or kind of a producer that was on par with, you know, major directors. I don't think she would have said that at all. She was too modest. Yeah.
But as you mentioned, the interviews is interesting. And just the sense that she had some kind of public persona, which was created in collaboration with, so in the case of Phantom Lady, Universal, I believe.
Yeah.
So what was the kind of public image of her that they would construct, and how neatly did it kind of fit with what she was actually like?
Right.
Was it an extension of that, or was it not?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So when she did debut with Phantom Lady as a producer, she was billed as the mistress of suspense, you know, kind of taking a cue from Alfred Hitchcock, who was great at, you know, branding himself. So as the master of suspense, and she did sell herself, and Universal did as well, as mutual, as someone who was going to make mysteries for women, you know, target kind of noirs for women, and also elevate the genre, not that it was called a genre then, right, but kind of elevate horrors and these kind of mysteries or noirs for a more, I don't know, discerning audience. So she really took Universal films and tried to lift them up. That was part of her job. But in terms of her image, right? Because she was also painting herself as at the vanguard of fashion, as a particular, you know, she wore Adrian's designs.
Yeah.
And she also wore Vera West, who was the head of costume at Universal, would help dress her. So it was this interesting kind of slippage between those stars who were wearing Universal styles, and then Joan herself, who would kind of wear those Universal, I don't know, styles out into the real world. Yeah. She was basically an icon, you know, in the sense that she was out there in lots of trades, lots of fan magazines, lots of newspapers, and she was highly visible. And I think that a lot of that was, I mean, everything is a construction. I don't want to say, right, that she wasn't partly constructed, but it got pretty close to the real Joan.
Well, because one of the things I took away was that she had a very lively social life as well, you know, cocktail parties with people like Marlene Dietrich and Billy Wilder. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you write about some of the relationships with people like Clark Gable, mm-hmm. as well as some relationships that weren't necessarily public knowledge. So I was just kind of wondering about your approach to writing about her private life, because obviously it's a source of interest.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I imagine there are certain things that there's just no way to know. And, and how do you approach that? So how did you tackle all of that?
Yeah. And, right. She, you know, Kirk Douglas, right. Gilbert Roland, Billy Wilder, Sidney Bernstein, is someone that I was told she had a really long-term kind of relationship with, but which I could kind of piece together through various interviews, but it certainly wasn't something I could document by going into Sidney Bernstein's papers, you know, right?
Yeah.
He's not writing letters and diaries. So, you know, one of the things that Norman Lloyd really wanted to emphasize, it's almost like Norman Lloyd in an interview with me set me off on a journey, because he said, you really need to understand that Joan had broad horizons sexually. Like, he just said it, right? Like, romantically, she really was, you know, she really was quite adventurous. And he said, I can't tell you, you know, how to study that or research that, but you need to go off and figure all that out for yourself. So he kind of, you know, it was kind of a challenge. So I tried to approach it basically by giving the information that I knew. Obviously, I would also talk to as many people as I could to triangulate, you know, the research. So if one person could corroborate another person, and then a third person could corroborate, even if it wasn't 100%, then I began to understand that it was reliable to a certain extent. But I didn't want to necessarily suggest in my book that I knew, right? How can you know very much factually? So I would, I try to give readers enough to think about, you know, without implying that we know everything.
I'm just wondering, is it deeply frustrating as a biographer, though, when you find out about something that maybe you can't get to the stage where it can go in the book, and there's maybe, you know, you haven't got the bit of paper that confirms it or whatever. Is that very frustrating?
It is really frustrating. And as you know, there was one particular, you know, kind of where Eric Ambler said to someone who was taking care of Joan Harrison, like, right, this very big revelation that, you know, the only person that Joan ever loved was a woman, you know. And then I began to get more people who would kind of, after the third interview, they would call me back and they would say, well, there's something that I didn't tell you before. And they'd start to kind of reveal that there was an important aspect to Joan's identity. But and it would drive me down this kind of rabbit hole where I'd feel like, well, I must know who this quote unquote one woman was. And at a certain point I realized it probably just doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like it matters on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, if I can't come up with the one, you know, the one discovery, then at least it matters to the extent that Joan had a very private life, and that, you know, and what did it mean to live in a world where she couldn't disclose everything? That to me actually became more interesting, that she, you know, that she had to actually hide certain aspects of herself, and that, you know, that we may never know. One of the things that actually was quite helpful is, you know, I really actually wanted to find out what the friendship was like between Evelyn Keyes and Joan Harrison. This is one pointer that I go down this kind of quick path. And Alan Glasser, who was Tab Hunter's husband, gave me a whole box of letters between Joan Harrison and Evelyn Keyes toward the end of writing the book. And Alan Glasser was the executor to Evelyn Keyes' estate. this is basically, so Tab Hunter and Alan Glasser took care of Evelyn Keyes toward the end of her life. And he said that he'd never heard of Joan Harrison, but, you know, here, have at it. And he gave me dozens of letters. So that was one example of me kind of pouring through letter after letter, waiting to see if maybe there would be some ultimate revelation or disclosure of passion, you know?
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. But it was clear that they were extraordinarily close friends.
Okay, so in terms of her films, I'll confess I haven't seen most of those later ones that you write about. So things like Ride the Pink Horse or Circle of Danger. I was just kind of wondering which ones most stand out to you as, if she has these preoccupations, which films best express that of those post-Phantom Lady ones?
Well, you know, I think They Won't Believe Me. I don't know if you've seen They Won't Believe Me.
No.
It's one that surprises you because in terms of expressing Joan Harrison's own preoccupations, because it does focus on Robert Young, a man who's trying to basically fight for his innocence. It starts off as a courtroom drama. But one of the reasons that I would say that it is a quote unquote Joan Harrison movie, you know, if you're looking to find her own themes, is because its premise is, you know, that Robert Young's character is the main character. Some people call him an homme fatale, right? That he's actually the homewrecker. He's the femme fatale, yeah, of the movie. But the truth is that you actually just use, the film uses him as a lens into all of these different women. And you look at the women in his life whose lives he basically did destroy, but also there's no femme fatale, right? They're just basically ways of exploring how marriage and heterosexual romance and these hopes and dreams for the American kind of capitalist fantasy of happiness. All of these are basically put under a microscope. And that's where Joan Harrison's own interests were. You know, she really liked to challenge the idea of a happy marriage.
I suppose people need to read the book to get all the detail about her producing career, but something that's particularly interesting is the way she left some of these positions. So I think when she left RKO, when Howard Hughes comes in, and then later an abrupt departure from Columbia. So part of what you were saying, perhaps, you know, she doesn't stand for nonsense, yeah, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she does leave Universal during this, you know, kind of problem with The Strange Affair of Uncle Harry, which is in 1946, I think. And that is just an example of her fighting for the artistic freedom of her director, you know, and her own artistic integrity. And she just storms out at the end of the making of a movie and also walks out on her own three movie contract. And that's a big deal. And I think that might be a pivot point where she loses a lot of clout in her own reputation, her own career. But yeah, she walks out just a year or two later from RKO when Howard Hughes comes in. And it's clear that he's actually got a lot. He's involved with the Red Scare. So she sees, you know, that he's going to come in and kind of put his foot down in terms of HUAC, but also he issues this memorandum that says, you know, unless your movie is about one of two things, right, fighting or fornication, you can forget it. So she realizes that anything she wants to make that's interesting in terms of a feminist theme is out. And so she walks away. And the Columbia thing with Harry Cohn is quite interesting because I think that she realizes at that point that she might be gray-listed. She might be in trouble in terms of the blacklist. So she leaves Columbia and leaves the country.
And well, I was just about to say, it'd be remiss if we didn't speak a bit about her television work. But part of her television production was she used TV as kind of a pipeline to bring blacklisted people back to work. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents and the Alfred Hitchcock Hour is where she really thrives. It's a great kind of third act to her career. But she also sees it as a way to bring back a lot of people who had been blacklisted, writers, directors and actors, people like, Kim Hunter is somebody that Joan Harrison actually brought back when she was making Janet Dean. The Registered Nurse, which was as early as 1953 or 1954. But Norman Lloyd, who ended up being the associate producer on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, is someone that she fought really hard to bring back from the blacklist. He was essentially down and out and had no money and was, I think, working in theater. And she worked behind the scenes to bring him back for Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You have people like Paul Henreid, right, who'd been in Casablanca and a number of Hollywood films. And he ends up directing, I think, over 20 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Even Lewis Milestone, the director Lewis Milestone, she brings in.
So just a couple of questions on the TV work, I guess, before we start to wrap up. But do you think she would have had any qualms about moving to television, given that it had a different kind of standing compared to cinema in those days? Not that we necessarily have to accept those distinctions, but that's a lot, you know, a lot of people felt that way.
Right.
Do you think she would have had any qualms about that?
That is a really good question, given her snobbishness, you know, and given how many people were looking down on television as it began. But I'm thinking not, because even in the late 1940s, she was working on developing contracts for Robert Montgomery with TV. So I think she saw it as a logical development and something. Especially, I think she was just scrappy, right? She was a work hound and she needed work. And so whatever, she was a pragmatist, and whatever was interesting, you know, whatever interesting developments were happening, she wanted to be in the mix.
And in terms of Alfred Hitchcock Presents, so it sounds, I think the term you use is a prototype of the modern day showrunner. So this was all about the way she sustained the Hitchcock brand through that series. Is that right?
Yeah. So she knew, you know, what defined Alfred Hitchcock, right? And we have to remember that the TV series made him more famous worldwide, you know, than any of his films. It's really hard to think about it that way. But so she was there not only to do the work, the nuts and bolts of the work, but also to kind of certify that each show would carry the Hitchcock brand, would be something that he, and not so much even approved of, because these were made in 2 to 3 days, you know, so it's not as though quality, even quality was quite the issue, but just that it matched the Alfred Hitchcock kind of genre and what defined Alfred Hitchcock. And what's interesting, I think, is that I think people assume that he had more of a role on the series than he did, but he really just kind of looked at the script and okayed it at the beginning and then watched like a rough cut at the end. So she was there really from the very beginning to the very end, doing locations and casting and the rights and all that.
Yeah. Just about, I suppose, as you say, the television series helped bolster Hitchcock's standing. And then I found the end of the book quite poignant, because she sort of faded from public view in some ways, and it kind of coincided with Hitchcock was gaining in standing in terms of public appreciations and so on. It's just very sad now. It's taken what, like 40 years or more before Joan Harrison's had more of a spotlight shone on her, I guess, just a byproduct of the, you know, the myth of the great male genius or something.
Yeah. It is. And it's kind of the director's mystique, you know, still lives on and was definitely on the rise in the late 1960s and early 1970s, you know, in terms of the French New Wave and Francois Truffaut and all of those and the retrospectives that were happening of Hitchcock's work, you know, around college campuses and film festivals. So as a result of that, you know, Hitchcock. And he was alive, so he was someone who was basically perpetuating and helping to kind of write his own history, right? Write his own legacy. So at that very time, I think that he was definitely his own story was taking off in a new way, and hers was fading into the past. So it's taken a long time to bring her forward.
Yeah, which the book does really well, I think. Just to finish, really, so we've talked a lot about the specifics of Joan Harrison's life and her career, but you also say that she was representative of a wave of female power that was overtaking the industry. So that's an interesting idea, too, that she's kind of emblematic of something broader that's going on. So is that kind of her legacy, you would say, as a kind of a trailblazer, as part of the wave of producers, etc.
Yes, yes. And that I do want to highlight rather than emphasize her as an individual, right? You know, I mean, I don't do very much of this in the book, but it's really important to kind of step back contextually and recognize that as opposed to the classical era becoming a moment where there's a vacuum of powerful women,
yeah.
You know, the truth is that we have so many women who are making an impact, this kind of wave of powerful women in classical Hollywood. You know, I mean, there's so many screenwriters, for example. We have Anita Loos and Catherine Turney and Zoe Akins and Vicki Baum and Falco Vertel, right? And even Mary McCall Jr. was not only writing a ton of screenplays, but she was the head of the Screenwriters Guild of America for 3 terms. She was the president, you know, during this time in the 1940s. You have agents like Kay Brown, who was David O. Selznick's agent, right, who helped bring Gone with the Wind and Rebecca to the screen. And then you also have, I mean, not only people in costume and editing, you know, a lot of women that I think that we also need to bring to the foreground in terms of recognizing their power, but even actresses that we understand, like mm-hmm. Bette Davis, you know, and Joan Crawford, but they were also at the forefront of union work and guild work. This is something J.E. Smith, you know, in her book, Nobody's Girl Friday, has done a great job of outlining the importance of women across the board. And so Joan Harrison is not somebody that competed. She was not a competitive person, right? Who was trying to kind of take all the power. She was somebody who was trying to lift other women up.
Okay. I think that's probably a very nice note to end on. Unless, Christina, there's anything else you'd like to say about Joan Harrison, but I guess people should go and buy the book. That's what I was saying.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to share all of this. And it's a great note to end on. Yeah.
Okay, so the book is out now, and I assume people can find that wherever good books are sold. But Christina, where can people find you online? Are you active on social media particularly?
I am, yeah. So authorchristinalane.com is my website, and you could go there to find my other Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, authorchristinalane.com. You can also look, Phantom Lady is often my handle if you want to find me out there.
Great stuff. Well, thanks, Christine. It's been really nice to kind of pick your brain about Joan Harrison today. Listeners, you can find the Movie Palace in all the usual places. We're on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook, also on Instagram. We'll be back with another new episode soon. So I hope you can join us next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Pick a disc.
And I bought Riot first, and I was like, oh, I really like this. And then I went back and bought their first album, which I can't think of the name of the first one right now, but I listened to Riot more than I did the first one for sure. Yes, I recently found my old iPod, and you know how it used to, there's a section under settings that would tell you your most listened to songs? This was the top, like, however many tracks it is, like 14 slots. And then it was everything else I listened to.
Right in the childhood.
Robin, the hooded man, doo-doo, mate. Before we do anything else, that soundtrack.
Yeah, you're a big fan of it, aren't you? Digging it. I could see the admiration for it in your little twinkle in your eyelids.
It put a tear. It's beautiful, beautiful music. By a band called Clannad, who obviously played that kind of music generally.
Yeah.
And it won a BAFTA.
Oh, okay.
That's because it deserved it.
Yeah, you know what? It definitely fit the aesthetic to the shows.
Cinemortuary Podcast.
Yeah, I want to say, and I don't like say this lightly, but this might be my favourite 2 minutes of any film we've reviewed on the podcast so far.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking wild. It is pretty wild.
Sure. If I was given the director's chair and $5 million, this is the sort of thing I'd do.
You'd do that for 90 really minutes.
Yes.
Hit him with a roulette wheel
just
again.
Just non-stop.
What if he vomits playing cards? Beautiful.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.